Hello, and welcome to our program, Moving the Needle in Bipolar 1 Depression, Novel Strategies to Improve Patient Outcome. I'm Roger McIntyre, Professor of Psychiatry and Pharmacology at the University of Toronto. I'm the Chairman and the Executive Director of the Brain and Cognition and Discovery Foundation in Toronto and Director at the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. The learning objectives of today's program is to evaluate the role of the D3 receptor, its function and pathogenesis in bipolar disorder. We're also going to be covering the current state of the union or treatments for persons who suffer from bipolar disorder as a second objective, and thirdly, to discuss novel and innovative treatments for bipolar disorder that take advantage of new mechanisms of action. Let's, if we can, begin by revisiting bipolar disorder and the overall illness and how it presents. We know that bipolar disorder is a common and lifelong severe mental disorder that affects approximately 1 to 2% of the general population. Although mania defines bipolar disorder, results from clinical as well as epidemiologic studies converge and indicate that the depressive symptoms of bipolar disorder are the predominant presentation of the illness. In addition to being the predominant presentation of the illness, depressive symptoms are also the index presentation, that is, when a person begins to manifest observable characteristics of bipolar disorder, depressive symptoms are how this individual often first presents. Along with being the predominant presentation, individuals with bipolar disorder, when they utilize healthcare services, are more likely to utilize healthcare services when they are in a state of depression. We've learned from many lines of evidence that bipolar disorder is not only an impairing condition on its own right, but is one of the most impairing medical disorders that we have. The impairment in bipolar disorder cuts across role function at home and outside the home. And when we look at individuals who have bipolar disorder as a function of polarity, what we learn is that the depressive symptoms of bipolar disorder are significantly much more impairing from the point of view of attendance and productivity at work, as well as educational attainment, quality of life, and day-to-day adjustment. Along with the hazards posed by bipolar depression from the point of view of day-to-day functioning, we know that depressive symptoms of bipolar disorder predispose suicidality and suicidal behavior, a very unfortunate and tragic outcome for many people who have bipolar disorder. So taken together, bipolar disorder clearly is a heterogeneous disorder, with depressive symptoms being the predominant presentation of this illness. Let's, if we can, have a look at a 3D animation that illustrates the neuroanatomical changes that are associated with bipolar depression. During the past two decades, convergent evidence from postmortem studies as well as the studies utilizing non-invasive imaging such as functional and structural MRI indicate that in adults who have bipolar disorder, there are changes in the brain's structure, volume, and interconnectivity. When we zoom in or look at regions of the brain, we discover something very relevant to us as clinicians. As you can see, we have changes in not only the structure, but the volume of key brain regions that subserve cognition, affect regulation, reward, and motivation. These regions include, but are not limited to, the prefrontal cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex, and various parts of the striatum. What's also important to highlight is that within these regions, there's a progressive loss of cellular material, that is the loss of neuronal material, and we believe this is what leads to the hypoactivation, in other words, the decreased activation of these regions and these circuits. Taken together, this anatomy and these observations, which we now have replicated, give us a framework for understanding why patients experience problems with cognition, motivation, sadness, depression, as well as the vegetative symptoms of depression. The pathogenesis of bipolar disorder is complex and certainly heterogeneous. One neurochemical system that's been implicated in the pathogenesis in the treatment of bipolar depression is dopamine. There are four discrete dopamine circuits within the brain: the tuberoinfundibular pathway, nigrostriatal, mesolimbic, and mesocortical. These circuits are comprised of different receptors, and depending on which circuit and which region, we are seeing different relative expressions of receptors. Dopamine receptors number 5, D1 to D5, and the typology, that is the way we categorize them, is into D1-like and D2-like. The D1-like receptors comprise the D1 and the D5 receptor. The D2-like are the D2, 3, and 4. Now, we learned so much about the function of these receptors by where they are located. For example, we know that there are D1 receptors in the prefrontal cortex that suggest that they're playing some role in perhaps cognitive function. We know that D2 receptors are located in, for example, the motor region of the brain, and this is thought to be why blockade of these receptors results in movement disorders. We know that D2 receptors are also located in reward areas of brain, and that's thought to play a role in mood as well as in feeding behavior. The D3 receptors are receptors located predominantly in the reward area of the brain, such as the ventral striatum and the nucleus accumbens, and they're also located in the hippocampus, a key brain region subserving cognition. This localization pattern alone gives us reasons to believe that by engaging D3 receptors, we could be able to help patients in key dimensions of bipolar depression, including but not limited to aspects of motivation, reward, as well as cognition. We've also learned from other lines of research that people who have bipolar disorder, notably bipolar depression, are more prone to binge eating behavior, as well as a greater propensity to obesity and excess weight. We now believe that this is in part due to a disturbance in dopaminergic signaling, particularly in the reward area. Taken together, what in fact is illustrated by this particular animation we're about to see is that dopamine receptor engagement has very different implications for the efficacy of a treatment as well as potential side effects. Let's watch this 3D animation on dopamine receptors explored. Dopamine controls various human functions such as cognition, motivation, reward, and eating behavior. We now know there are 4 discrete dopamine circuits in the brain, and as you can see, these circuits are populated with dopamine receptors. We have 5 types of dopamine receptors, D1 to D5, and the categorization is into D1-like and D2-like. D1 are the D1 and D5, and they are activating. They activate cyclic AMP. We have the D2-like, which is D2, D3, and D4, which are inhibitory. What's really interesting about the neuroscience around dopamine is that these receptors are not just randomly distributed. These receptors have key distribution patterns that give us hints as to what their functional importance is. For example, we know that the D2 receptors located pre and postsynaptically are involved in motor control as well as various aspects of reward. As you can see, the D3 receptors are disproportionately expressed in the reward area of the brain, like the ventral striatum, and also in regions of the brain relevant to cognition, like hippocampus. This observation, as well as others, gives us reasons to believe that the D3 receptors are critical to aspects of motivation, reward, mood, and cognitive processes, providing the impetus to target these receptors in patients who suffer from bipolar disorder. Let's reiterate, if we can, a point illustrated beautifully in the animation video, that being the D3 dopamine receptor. A reminder that the D3 receptors are disproportionately distributed in the reward areas of the brain, including the ventral tegmental area, the nucleus accumbens, and also areas responsible for cognition, like the hippocampus. This is why we believe that engaging D3 receptors could hold promise to help patients in areas of motivation deficit, reward problems, and cognitive discontrol and depression. We know that when we engage the D3 receptor through D3 partial agonism, this results in a relative increase in release of dopamine in brain regions like the prefrontal cortex, which we believe adds to improved cognitive abilities. In addition to having a direct effect on aspects of motivation, reward, and cognition, we know that dopamine may have indirect effect on these experiences by our patients through other intriguing systems like inflammation. We've learned so much how inflammation now could be responsible for why many of our patients are experiencing depressive symptoms like apathy, amotivation, and difficulties focusing and thinking. And we've now learned that within the brain, there are immune cells, the microglia. It's not without our interest that dopamine regulates the microglia. That is, it regulates the inflammatory system, providing a testable hypothesis that perhaps indirectly dopamine's helping motivation, reward, and cognition, in part through the immune system. We reach to animal models to provide a basis for hypothesizing. And when we look at models of D3 activity, we learn aspects that we think could inform our understanding of D3 agents in humans. For example, we know in animal models, when we knock out the D3 receptor, that is, we block it entirely, the animals perform better in paradigms of cognition. That is, they perform better in, for example, exploring their environment. We also know that in animal models, when we block or we knock out these D3 systems, the animal exhibits greater motivation and greater reward. Again, these are animal studies. They provide the basis for hypothesizing that blocking or regulating D3 could help cognition and could help motivation and reward. Let's now, if we can, begin to look at how the different antipsychotics engage D2, D3 systems and the implications for our patients in bipolar depression. Towards understanding the mechanism of action of antipsychotics, let's briefly discuss dopamine localization in the brain. Dopamine is localized in three compartments. Two are in the presynaptic neuron, in the cytosol and in the vesicle. The third compartment's the synapse. Upon release from the presynaptic neuron, dopamine then translocates across the cleft and binds to the postsynaptic receptors. More specifically, D2 blocking antipsychotic agents block the postsynaptic D2 receptor. This results in attenuation of psychosis and agitation, but results in motor side effects like EPS. Also has experiences for patients, as you can see, like akinesia, apathy, depression, and interference with cognition. In contradistinction, D3 receptors, highlighted here, are identified on pre- and postsynaptic neurons, and when they are binded to with D3 blocking antipsychotics, this retains the dopamine tonus. As a consequence, we not only see attenuation of psychosis and agitation, but we also see lower risk of motor side effects and improvement in areas like motivation, reward, depression, and likely also cognitive experiences. Let's, if we can, now have a look at the FDA-approved treatments for bipolar disorder, with a particular emphasis on bipolar depression. In addition to having these FDA-approved agents, there are other treatments that are considered as potential treatments in patients who have bipolar depression as a next step strategy. These treatments include lithium and lamotrigine. Again, agents that are not FDA approved for bipolar depression, but have been identified in evidence-based and expert guidelines as potential treatment alternatives in individuals who have bipolar depression. Beyond the treatments that I've mentioned so far, we have relatively little data supporting most other agents in bipolar depression. With respect to neurostimulation, the best evidence we have, particularly in treatment-resistant bipolar depression, is with electroconvulsive therapy, with promising evidence now for neurostimulation techniques like RTMS. We should not forget psychosocial strategies, which have been shown effectively to reduce the return of bipolar depression, particularly modalities of therapy like interpersonal social rhythm therapy, cognitive therapies, and also psychoeducation approaches. When we look at the atypicals as a class of agent in bipolar disorder, what we've learned is that not all atypical antipsychotics are capable of significantly reducing depressive symptoms in adults with bipolar disorder. We have compelling evidence now for cariprazine, lurasidone, quetiapine, and olanzapine when combined with fluoxetine. Other atypicals like aripiprazole and ziprasidone have been studied in bipolar depression but did not demonstrate superiority over placebo. The message is that we need to be very careful in our appraisal of the evidence and know it well so that we're providing for patients the treatments that have been proven to work and are in fact FDA approved. On that note, over the last two decades, there's been many studies that have sought to determine how common are antidepressants prescribed in bipolar disorder. The question is an important one given the ubiquity of bipolar depressive symptoms in our patients, and also because we know that there are hazards posed by antidepressants, such as induction of hypomania and mania or mixed features, and or the destabilization of bipolar disorder over the long term, resulting in a dysrhythmic mood instability. What we've learned is that antidepressants are continuing to be prescribed at a very high rate in individuals who suffer from bipolar disorder. In fact, antidepressants in some studies are prescribed as much, if not more, than some of the FDA-approved agents. This is obviously a concern. That is a concern that arises this gap between the evidence for antidepressants and their prescription frequency. Well, what is the evidence? Well, frankly, the evidence has been equivocal at best. In fact, original studies in bipolar I disorder, which have been subjected to systematic reviews as well as meta-analysis, indicate that we still at this time do not have clinically significant benefit with most conventional antidepressants in bipolar disorder, where they've been often studied as adjunct to other agents. Moreover, there's a lack of long-term studies that have sought to determine what's the long-term effect of antidepressants in bipolar I disorder. We certainly have plenty of evidence that for some people, antidepressants could be destabilizing some of our patients. So taken together, at least in bipolar disorder, we don't have compelling evidence that these agents are reliably effective in most individuals. Hence, most evidence-based guidelines would demote conventional antidepressants to really further down the algorithm as treatment alternatives for people who have bipolar depression. Earlier, we've talked a lot about dopamine and more specifically D3 receptors and the potential opportunities afforded by the neuroscience around D3. We have a long history of considering dopamine treatments in adults who have bipolar disorder. The dopamine-based treatments are mechanistically very dissimilar, and the results of this meta-analysis, which included many different types of agents that have disparate effects on dopamine systems, suggested that there are potential benefits in alleviating depressive symptoms in individuals who have bipolar disorder. Cariprazine is an atypical antipsychotic and the first of a D3-preferring D2, D3 partial agonist. Cariprazine is now approved for the treatment of bipolar depression, as well as the treatment of bipolar mania in mixed features. We have now recent evidence indicating that cariprazine, along with attenuating features of mania and mixed states, is also capable of improving symptoms of bipolar depression. The results that you're seeing illustrated on the slide represent both the primary and a key secondary endpoint from one of the pivotal trials with cariprazine, which replicates a previous positive finding in bipolar depression, that after 6 weeks of therapy, cariprazine was effective at improving the symptoms of bipolar disorder. Moreover, looking at response and remission rates using the MADRS, or categorical improvement on the HAM-D, we see benefits with cariprazine in bipolar depression that are thought to be clinically relevant. It remains a testable hypothesis that the benefits that are observed with cariprazine in bipolar depression are in part due to this unique effect on the D3 system. Indeed, it remains an open and testable hypothesis to what extent we can expect benefits in cognition in other aspects of bipolar disorder, including comorbidities like alcohol and drug misuse, which certainly represent interesting future studies. That's it. We can now summarize the key messages of this presentation. First, bipolar disorder is a serious, lifelong, often chronic condition. It's a condition that manifests largely as depressive symptoms, being the predominant presentation as well as the index presentation. Along with being the predominant and index presentation, individuals with bipolar disorder are more likely to seek out health care during the depressive phase of the illness. It's this latter observation that provides the impetus for us to recommend screening for bipolar disorder in any individual utilizing health care for depressive symptoms. Furthermore, other lines of evidence indicate that the depressive symptoms of bipolar disorder disproportionately account for the morbidity of the illness, the loss of quality of life, the functional impairment, as well as the serious hazard of suicidality so often seen in bipolar patients. Finally, we know that bipolar depressive symptoms are highly associated with select comorbidities like obesity, cardiovascular disease, which also add to the overall morbidity of the illness. Research has indicated clearly that the pathogenesis of bipolar disorder is complex and multifactorial. One key system implicated in the pathogenesis of bipolar disorder is the dopaminergic system. We've learned that the D3 receptor within the dopaminergic system plays a key role in experiences of motivation, reward, depressive symptoms, and cognition. Not only common symptoms in bipolar disorder, but symptoms that have not been well addressed with most existing treatments for bipolar disorder. This observation of the mechanistic role of D3 subserving these key experiences provides the basis for us giving individuals treatments that engage the D3 receptor with an overall aim to reduce depressive symptoms, but also to mitigate key symptoms relevant to patients' quality of life and function, such as motivation, reward, and cognition. Indeed, pharmacologic treatments are essential for people who have bipolar disorder. They're part of a larger chronic disease management that includes psychoeducation, in many cases, manualized-based psychotherapy, and indeed paying careful attention to patients' somatic or physical health and not just their mental health. Thank you for joining me for today's program.